We have a guest waiting to join us. Tim Kirkshian from ESPN and ESPN.com joining us now on the Loud Security Systems Newsmaker line. Tim, always a pleasure to speak with you. We know baseball isn't going on, but you're doing something that I think is the next best thing, your daily baseball fix.
Yeah, this was my idea. I needed to pass the time. I missed the game so much. Much of my friends are all sad. So I just decided, all right, maybe I can give my own little take on this date in baseball history, all the great things that happen on each day, with the understanding these are meant to bring a smile to your face. They are meant to inform you a little bit, but even make you laugh once in a while, because it's important that we do this now. So this was done for all of our baseball fans who are missing the game, guys like me. And hopefully people enjoy this. I know I've enjoyed doing it. It's a lot more work than I thought it was going to be, but it's been great fun.
Well, the good news is we all have extra time to do some work. Today you focus on Bo Jackson in 1993, among other things. And I think people that are not old enough, they don't realize what a phenomenon Bo Jackson was.
Yeah, Jimmy Stewart, a scout, once told me, he was joking, of course. He said, here's how good Bo Jackson is. I saw him hit a 500-foot homer, then he ran out and caught it before it hit the ground, and then he threw it back the whole plate in the air. That's how remarkable Bo Jackson is. He was kidding, obviously, but people aren't kidding when they say what they saw. I mean, George Brett told me he never missed an at-bat by Bo Jackson because he didn't want to risk missing something that he's never seen before. Mike McFarland, who played with him in the minor leagues and the major leagues, told me Bo's in the minor leagues, he breaks his bat. And typical Bo, he knows he breaks his bat, but he goes, I don't care, I'll just use it anyway. And then he hit a home run over the center field fence. And Mike McFarland said, all right, this guy is a freak. And I was there that night at Memorial Stadium live when he made that catch in left center field and then ran up the left center field fence like a race car on a ramped turn. It was the most remarkable thing I've ever seen, but I shouldn't have been surprised because I believe at one point in his career, he was the fastest player in the league and the strongest player in the league at the same time. And I don't think anyone else could ever say that in baseball history.
Now, he wasn't the same after the hip replacement surgery. On this date, though, in 93, his first at-bat since the hip replacement surgery, he hits a home run. You want to talk about something that may never happen again? That could be it, Tim.
Right, and that was kind of the point. It wasn't that he hit a home run. He hit an artificial hip, and he did something else that made it look at him like, how are you able to do that? Mike McFarland told me that Bo is a big bow hunter, and he brought his bow and arrows into the clubhouse one day, and the guys were all trying, the players were trying to cock the bow, like pull the strings back. And Mike McFarland said no one on the team could do it. He said, I put the bow on the ground, put my foot on it for leverage, and I still couldn't put it back. And then Bo showed us how he does it, and he pulled those strings back like it was pulling back the strings of a harp. That's what Mike McFarland told me. That's how strong Bo Jackson was. And he was so fast. Harold Reynolds once told me that whenever Bo got on first base and Harold's playing second, he used to yell to Bo, this is not football. Meaning on the double play, Harold or Steele, Harold didn't want 230 pounds with metal spikes coming at him at a million miles an hour. That's who Bo Jackson was.
And actually ensure that the story gets even better, he promised his mom he was going to hit a home run when he comes back. He does it, gets the baseball, and then there's a story about what he did with the baseball. I also enjoyed yesterday, if you're going to start something out, happy 7-15 day, certainly in the city of Atlanta, but baseball fans overall, whenever you have a story, maybe one of those that hasn't been heard about Hank Aaron, where you think you've heard just about everything, those are the ones that I'm really looking forward to.
Yeah, again, the story I told yesterday was about Tom House, young reliever in the Braves' bullpen. And all the relievers the day of the game in a lottery system with seniority were allowed to choose where they wanted to stand in the bullpen in order to catch Hank's 7-15th, because they knew it was happening that night. So Tom House is way out in left center field, and he says, everyone's in a better spot than me. And Hank hit it. He said, it came right to me. I didn't even have to move. And then he ran the ball into home plate and presented it to Hank. And he told me Hank had tears in his eyes. And he said, I've never seen Hank Aaron cry before. And that just goes to show you how emotional, stressful, powerful that moment was when Hank Aaron passed Babe Ruth on the all-time home run
list. Tim, do you know, though, he's on record? We did a conversation a few years ago where he said, but that's not the home run he's most proud of. In the pennant year in 57, he hit one in extra innings to actually clinch the pennant for the Milwaukee Braves. And he absolutely has said that that home run was more important to him than 715 because it was a team thing as opposed to an individual thing.
Right. Well, that's absolutely true, because anyone who knows Hank Aaron, and I know him pretty well, team is all that he ever all mattered to him, and winning was all that mattered to him. And again, you know, the Milwaukee Braves, they hadn't been to the World Series in a while or at all, and they really needed a boost. And Hank Aaron was the guy that got him there with send him to the World Series. And so he's a team guy all the way, no doubt about that.
Tim Kirkshen with us on the Loud Security Systems Newsmaker line. I encourage you to check out the Daily Baseball Fix at ESPN.com. Also on this date in 1981, Fernando Valenzuela makes his first start. And truly, Tim, the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. I don't know if I have the numbers off the top of my head, but I think his first eight starts, he won them all. He completed them all. He had five shutouts. And I think he allowed five runs in 72 innings.
Yeah, you're off by one. That was great memory. Four runs in 72 innings, but you're right. First eight starts, he completes them all with five shutouts.
Right. And again, he wasn't even supposed to start, but Jerry Royce was sick, so they put Fernando in there. And that was the start of Fernando mania. And I was covering baseball at that time, and we were all just dazzled. Like, who is this kid? He's only 20 years old. Where did he come from? And Fernando mania just completely took off. And I also wrote that in the World Series that year, which the Dodgers won, I'm going to be close on this, he pitched a complete game. He won, I think it was 5-4. He gave up six. He had 16 base runners allowed in a 9-inning game. They left him in for 16 base runners. That would never happen today. That would be impossible. And yet he completed the game and won the game because they looked at him and said, well, it's still Fernando Valenzuela. He struggled a little bit and he's tired, but he's going to get the last outs, and he did.
Tim, you talk about a storied organization in the Dodgers. Chris and I had a chance to go out to Los Angeles, tour Dodger Stadium in the offseason. And again, with all of the big names, he is right up there. He is a god in Dodger history.
Yeah, and he should be, because he was not just a great pitcher, but the whole Latino background there from Mexico, L.A., Southern California. I mean, it just created just a new fan base there. And he was so charismatic, the way he did things, the way he used to look at the sky when he used to pitch. I mean, we all looked and said, what is he looking at? His eyes are going up in the air, not at home plate. And he was just so colorful and just had such a presence about him. He just took the sport by storm in 1981.
Hey, Tim, do you think there's enough personality in the game in this regard? Look, I know what the commissioner said about Mike Trout. He shouldn't have gone down that road, because Mike Trout is a model citizen. He's not going to spin plates and be a dancing bear for anybody. It's just not who he is. But Fidrich, Fernando, even, you know, I was watching the other night. They had the 21-31, the Cal Ripken game on. I had forgotten the ovations and how long that actually went. And baseball needs moments. I hope it happens organically. I know we're all starved for something where we keep scores actually taking place. But does baseball have, because I think people forget about that stuff. I think people sort of like, hey, did baseball ever have, yeah, baseball used to have that. We're all just trying to find it. I don't think you can manufacture it, though.
No, and that's what was so great about the Cal Ripken night. I was there, of course. I wrote all of that for Sports Illustrated. All of that was organic. When they pushed him out on the field to make that famous lap, by the way, they pushed him out at 9:31 p.m., which in military time is 21:31. We all got a big kick out of that when you think about it. And Ripken had no idea what to expect, and he ran around those bases, slapping five with people, hugging others, pointing at fans that he knew, because that's the kind of guy that he was. But that's what made that night so great. We knew that the record was going to be broken, but we didn't know what was going to happen after that. And that 22 minutes is the most powerful night that I've ever spent in a major league park. I hope we can have another something like that. My guess is he was a one-of-a-kind kind of player. The game is different today, and I'm not sure we could ever duplicate anything quite like that.
Tim Kirchin, our guest on the Loud Security Systems Newsmaker line here on the Fan, 680 and 93.7 FM. What are your thoughts on that initial plan of playing all 30 teams, in fact, playing in Arizona?
Well, look, I'm up for anything that's going to get us to start playing again. But this one is hard to believe that it could go off in this way. I mean, there's so many roadblocks in the way of that, and I just don't see that happening just because I'm not sure the players are going to agree to leave home for 4 months in a quarantine situation, play in the same place every night with no fans there. That just doesn't sound like baseball to me. But we all have to accept the fact that we're in for a wildly unusual season if we play at all. So I'm willing to put up with anything, but the number one thing is everyone's got to be safe. They can't come back until this virus is gone, because the one thing they can't do is start playing baseball and then after a week say, all right, we've got to stop now. Baseball doesn't work that way. So it's going to be very tricky. There are some good points to the Arizona plan, but I don't see it happening in the way it was laid out.
Tim, I don't know how far in advance you're doing each of these pieces on ESPN.com now. I don't know how much time you're going to give yourself. But are you looking forward to sort of reading something that maybe you had heard, kind of forgotten, didn't know all the details on, now I have a relatable story? Because baseball is littered with this day in history, whether it's the Tuffy Rhodes of the world, is the guys that, you know, their cup of coffee and their moment all existed on the same day. How far advance are you doing these, and how much are you looking forward to maybe being surprised as you actually start to sort through them?
Well, Chris, that's my favorite part. First off, I've written through May the 5th, so I'm a month ahead of time because I have to do all these videos to go with them. But my favorite part is to, because I don't know what happened on May the 7th or May the 6th, but I looked up May the 6th today, and that's Willie Mays' birthday. That's the day Kerry Wood struck out 20. I mean, that's the really fun part for me, is when I look at a date and say, oh, my gosh. And then when I see something, I say, well, I could write about that, and I could write about that, and I could write about that. And it brings back all of these great memories that I have of the people I covered and the games that I saw. And sometimes it's somebody who's playing right now. So every day is a little bit different, and I really enjoy looking at this date in baseball history and then putting, since I'm doing it, my own little personal spin
on it. Have you ever done how many ballparks because of teardowns, rebuilds, new stadiums, and everything else? Have you ever figured out how many ballparks you've actually been in?
Yeah, I've covered a game in 60 different ballparks now, covered a game. Now, that includes Fort Bragg, where they only played one game. That includes Williamsport and things like that. And now Omaha, I covered those games. But, if you count one game, I've covered a game in 60 different ballparks. And, of course, I've covered the Braves in 3 different ballparks, the Twins in 3 different ballparks, and pretty soon the Rangers in 3 different ballparks. So, I've counted those up. I have a running count because it means something to me.
And Earl Weaver is your guy. You talked about coming up as a young writer, being around Earl Weaver. I believe you wrote the piece the other day on Earl Weaver, did you not?
Yeah, Earl taught me so much about the game. He made me laugh so many times. Earl could be a little difficult with people, but he was charming as he wanted to be. He was so brilliant. He was so funny. Pat Kelly was an outfielder on their team. And while he's playing with the Orioles, he's decided to join the ministry. So he waits for the perfect time to go to Earl and give him the really big news in his life. And he goes to Earl and he says, Earl, I'm going to walk with the Lord. And Earl said, I'd rather you walk with the bases loaded. That's usually how the conversations went with Earl. But he, in the end, his players played like crazy for him. And he's one of the greatest managers of all time.
Tim, the other part, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention this past week, Al Kaline passes away. And I know that we've talked to you about this, and we've had a chance to talk about it down in spring training when it was a little bit more relaxed. The oral history, the audio history, the picture history, how important it is for the game. You talked about just keeping a running count of being in 60 different ballparks because it mattered to you. I don't know what, maybe you have a quick Al Kaline story, but the other part of this is, you mentioned Willie Mays' birthday, Hank Aaron, and these guys who get above 80 years old. I really hope there's documentation or enough documentation on these guys as we go forward, because you don't want to lose these stories.
Yeah, Al Kaline, I was very close with Al Kaline, so that was a crushing loss because he's a Baltimore guy, and I covered the Baltimore Orioles for a long time. He told me when he was in high school, he was a better basketball player than he was a baseball player, which speaks to his athleticism, of course. But how good of a basketball player must he have been, because he won a batting title when he was 20 years old. He also had 399 homers without hitting 30 in a season. So that's the most career homers by anyone who never hit 30 in a season. But he was the most elegant, regal kind of man. Everybody loved Al Kaline. It was impossible not to love him. Sparky Anderson once told me, my day is always a better day when I see Al Kaline. And defensively, I think you could at least make the case that after Roberto Clemente, the best defensive right fielder of all time was Al Kaline.
That's how good he was. Yeah, it's funny you mentioned regal, and certainly classy comes to mind with Al Kaline, because he had every interaction sort of mattered to people, not just Tiger fans. But if you talk about his background, his father was a broom maker. You know, he talked to, about not having enough money. His uncles would have to drive him to different fields because there was nothing really in his neighborhood. So the ability to rise above, and a lot of these guys have done it, the ability to rise above what it looks like their path might be, is pretty amazing. That a guy who came from those humble backgrounds becomes a guy who becomes so eloquent in terms of being the face of not only an organization, but being a Hall of Fame player and carrying it really well.
Yeah, and he's the greatest player ever to come out of Baltimore. As far as public schools go, Babe Ruth doesn't count in that group. And this is so beautiful. This is how baseball is just so appropriate sometimes. Al Kaline got hit number 3,000 at Memorial Stadium in Baltimore off of Dave McNally. So he got 3,000 at his home ballpark, the one he grew up watching games and all that. And that's what made Al Kaline such a special player, is that he appreciated everything around him, including his difficult journey to the major leagues.
And check out Tim Kirchner's Daily Baseball Fix. You'll appreciate that every day at ESPN.com. Tim, we'll talk again real soon. Thanks for the time.
Okay, guys. See you.
Tim Kirchner from ESPN and ESPN.com on the Loud Security Systems Newsmaker Live.